We're being set up to fail. And World War III, how long can we teeter on the brink? Coming up on today's Citizens Report. Welcome to the Citizens Report for the 18th of April 2024. I'm Elisa Barwick. Joining me today is Citizens Party researcher Richard Barden. Welcome, Richard.
Thanks, Elisa.
And on today's show, we'll give you a report on the last, the 13th and the last, probably, hearing held by the Senate RARAC Committee on the bank closures and some really interesting things that came out of their hearing in Bribie Island. And then we're going to give you an update on the war front, which there's been some very overwhelming developments, but we'll help you situate it in your own mind and show the pathway that the world can come through this. And we'll particularly talk about Iran's retaliation against Israel, which happened last weekend. So stay tuned for that. Now, don't forget to hit the like button, make a comment below, share with this, engage on the discussions of these ideas in any way you can. Of course, always talking to your Member of Parliament, your local council about the solutions like a postal bank to bring that to the fore. You can find links below where you can subscribe to our regular weekly newsletter, which has all the backup content, the Australian Alert Service, and you can also donate. Of course, we've finished this round of 13 hearings in 13 months in which Robbie has been travelling around the country, and he's still up in Queensland on the way back from Bribie Island with other meetings to do. We always take advantage of being out on the road to catch up with all kinds of people along the way also. So please donate if you can to support us in this ongoing cause. Now, a couple of announcements before we get into the show proper. I wanted to just give a whistleblower update, if you like. Julian Assange's trial. So we've all been waiting, his family, of course, waiting with bated breath to hear a response from the United States. The UK proceedings were waiting to hear whether they would provide certain assurances before he was extradited, particularly in the matter of whether he would be subject to the death penalty, but also whether he would be able to access the First Amendment right to freedom of speech in the United States, because he's not an American citizen, of course, which is why he shouldn't even be being subject to this measure.
Yeah, this universal jurisdiction. Whereas, in fact, I should just mention, the amendments are restrictions on the power of the government. They're not rights it grants to US citizens only. That's just ridiculous.
So the US government came back on this matter during the week, and a diplomatic note was sent by the US Embassy in London to the Foreign Office, which said that Assange, quote, will have the ability to raise and seek to rely upon at trial protection under the First Amendment, which is very wishy-washy. It means, it says, you know, he can try to use it, doesn't assure that he'll, you know, be able to. And it also states that he is not charged and will not be tried for a death-eligible offence. Now, his Assange's wife, Stella, made comments about this, accusing the US authorities of issuing a non-assurance in relation to the First Amendment and a standard assurance in relation to the death penalty. She said it makes no undertaking to withdraw the prosecution's previous assertion that Julian has no First Amendment rights because he is not a US citizen. Instead, the US has limited itself to blatant weasel words claiming that Julian can seek to raise the First Amendment if extradited. So obviously this has not made his family feel in the slightest any bit better. Now, another update. One of our other whistleblowers that we are refusing to defend in this country is, of course, David McBride. And a couple of weeks ago, the ABC Four Corners program did a shameless show where they threw him under the bus by claiming that his motivations in revealing the documents that he revealed about Afghanistan were not released in order to expose war crimes because he was defending soldiers, which was it was his job to do.
He was a lawyer. That's what lawyers, you know, lawyers get assigned clients to defend. That's, you know, he's a government lawyer.
So while he was doing his job as a defence attorney, in it, with a lot of the cases of these soldiers were really, they were just defending themselves and they were scapegoated for the higher echelons of the military to cover up the situation. The ABC was claiming that he was basically defending these war criminals. Now, as to his motivation, that was made clear in a video, which you, we can put a link below. You can go and listen to it by Friendly Geordies that's just come out, which he shows that the affidavit that David McBride initially released indicates that he was, you know, blowing the whistle on the fact that Afghan civilian murders had, a blind eye had been turned to it at the same time as he was saying that soldiers were being scapegoated, you know, so that the upper echelons of the military could go scot-free. And as Friendly Geordie said, that's all you need to know. Look at that affidavit. This clears up this whole issue of what David McBride was saying from the get-go. He was very, very clear on his motivation, and the ABC should be absolutely ashamed at how they've tried to tarnish his reputation. And I just want to also mention, don't forget too, the other whistleblower or who comes into this general category, which is Dan Duggan.
Scapegoat. Fitted up for a non-existent crime, just as part of this whole McCarthyite agenda to demonise anything associated with China, because you know, he happened to have a business over there for a while.
And so he's really suffering, as is his family. So do look up him online as well, and if you can support any of these causes, they really need it. So with that said, let's get on to our first topic. We are being set up to fail. Now, those words were uttered by the mayor of Maranoa region in Queensland when she was interviewed during the hearing of the 13th hearing of the bank closures inquiry, which took place on Bribey Island on Tuesday. And what she was saying, and we'll hear a clip of this shortly, but she was just to give the general picture. She was making the point that these bank closures are setting up small towns to fail, because when banks close their branches, the local town just can't function. And bit by bit, as we've heard in all of these 13 sets of hearings, you know, businesses close, people go to the bigger centres, the local town, the local businesses and, you know, various operations like clubs and community centres, churches, everything, you know, they can't get change, they can't get cash, they can't operate in the way that they used to. So she was the first witness, and we'll hear from her in a moment. But just to set the scene, we'll put up some photos here, because this is the audience. So when the senators walked into the room, and they're used to being, I mean, the last hearing in Canberra, there were two people in the room, and one of them was Robert Barwick, and one of the witnesses, the ASIC representative. So usually when the senators walk into the room, and there's been a few where there's been, like, Junie had quite a good crowd, and I think the one in one of the ones in Western Australia as well. But particularly this room, when the senators walk in, you could see the look on their faces when they surveyed the room, as you can see in the picture, because there must have been, I don't know, somewhere from 50 to 100 people there. I've got no idea. But a lot of them, a large proportion of them, 95%, according to our State Secretary, Jan Pekelis, who was there, had Citizens Party hats, T-shirts, or were part of our movement, supporting our movement. So we're going to just listen to the way the chair of the inquiry, Matt Canavan, introduced the event, because he couldn't but acknowledge us.
It is great to be here today on Bribey Island, a beautiful place in a great state of Queensland. And this is our 13th public hearing on bank closures, and it is expected to be our last one. It's, I suppose, the first one we've had in an urban environment. So this is an inquiry into bank closures in regional Australia, but we have had and received a lot of complaints about branch closures in suburban areas and city areas even. And so we thought it would be worthwhile to hear from people in those environments as well about this very important issue. Given it's our final hearing, I want to thank everybody that's been involved throughout the inquiry. We've been doing this now for just over a year, travelled to every state in the country. And it's while it's a similar story everywhere, there is also some unique local experiences we continue to uncover. And there's obviously a very serious issue about the way especially major banks are treating their customers in smaller towns across Australia. We have had saved some bank branches from closing, so we appreciate the efforts of many here, including Robbie from the Citizens Party, and I think you can all have a branch meeting after this hearing by the looks of it. But I do appreciate, despite obviously not being in your political movement, I do appreciate all your involvement in this inquiry. It's helped us enormously, and as I say, I think it's had some success so far.
All right, so there you go. Now, so that was quite funny in that he said you may as well have a branch meeting. And I'll put up the photo, actually, of all of us afterwards on the screen, our ACP people with Robbie and co. And some people had already had to duck off before this photo was
that's
taken.
That's not the whole crowd.
Yeah, but you can see it's quite stunning. Now, let's hear from the mayor of the Maranoa region. Because this is the lady that, and you know, she talks about the bank closures and also a lot of banks where if they can't get staff on a particular day, they have to just shutter the doors or they're only open, as a lot of people will know from regional communities and local towns, they're only open for certain hours on certain days. So she maps that out.
Just to give you one example, we have a local business that's an hour and a half west of Roma that the depend on the community to pick up their banking and bring it to town for them. And then, of course, somebody brings it to town and then the bank is just unexpectedly closed, sometimes for consecutive days without any prior notice at all. And
Roma. Just to clarify, that's in Roma, is it? The bank is closed, you're saying?
No, the bank closed in Mitchell.
No, but when they bring the money in, they bring it into Roma, yeah. Do they? Yeah, so that's a big town.
They bring it into Roma.
Right.
It is a big town, and we have businesses that then they just simply can't do their banking because the bank's closed, which, of course, means they've got excess money on site. And you know, that too is mitigates a big problem as well. So we just, and as far as the post offices go, our post office they just don't have what they need. Like, we don't have post office, they don't have the facilities, they don't have ramps for prams or wheelchairs or wheelie walkers, so, and they don't have, you know, significant financial, to be able to do financial transactions. It's just really hard. Like, and, you know, we have in June that the bank might be open on a Thursday, but then all of a sudden nobody sends any staff out there from Roma, so it just doesn't open, full stop. I just find that, you know, they're setting us up to fail when we're looking to, you know, encourage people to come and live, work and play in our beautiful towns, and we can't meet the basic requirement, which is bank.
Okay, so, yeah, you get a very clear picture of the impact this is having on the local towns. And just bear in mind, when you hear these senators, they've had this repeated everywhere they've been. And, of course, one of the things that's becoming more and more clear is that the solution has to revolve around some banking alternative. Mm. And, of course, one of the things that's been raised by a lot of participants is a public bank of some kind, and we talked, you know, about the Tom Price hearing where the local council there has advanced plans to propose a local government bank, and that'll be put on the table at the local government association meeting. So, and they had witnesses, the LGA, at this hearing at Bribie Island. So there's a lot of proposals, but the postal bank idea is, of course, what we've been pushing, or a public bank that would operate through the post offices, because the post offices have a very big footprint.
Yeah, and they already have an actually legislated service obligation that the banks should have but don't.
That's right. Plus, they do banking, you know, so they're operating bank at post. They have a lot of the facilities they would need to operate as a bank in their own right already. Mm. Of course, there would be certain upgrades that would need to be made. But it's interesting when Malcolm Roberts, I'll run this clip of him now, where he discusses the proposal for a postal bank, and he gives a bit of elaboration on that, and he asks the representative or the witness who was there from the local post office, licensed post office on Bribie Island, her thoughts on it. And as you'll see, her response was very brief but very certain.
Thank you, Senator Ciccone. Senator Roberts.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Ms. Stride, for being here. I must say your opening statement was fabulous. The words that came through really strongly were care and trust. Now, you clearly have a very strong sense of responsibility to the community, and we see that in all LPOs. So, as you step in to the breach for the banks, doesn't that encourage the banks to have even less accountability because they know you'll pick up the services? I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. I'm saying, doesn't that encourage the banks to keep doing what they're doing?
Yes, I understand what you mean. But eventually, my income will not support me if they don't support us.
So, actually, your situation is one of wage theft.
Well, you could describe it as that.
I did. Would you agree? They're getting cheap services, and you're picking up their responsibility at a much lower cost, so they're making out like bandits.
Yes, all right.
Right. So you're in effect subsidising the community, and I know you take pride in that, but that's what's really going on. You mentioned these words. You provide cash to people so that they can, your quote, access their saved cash. So people are saving their money in the bank, and then the banks are making it difficult to access the cash. Seems a contradiction.
Yeah, absolutely.
So haven't the banks, because they're propped up by the governments when quite often in many, many ways, haven't the banks got an obligation to provide legal tender? That's the country's currency?
Forever.
Yeah. Now, let's turn to a people's bank. Are you familiar with what the original Commonwealth Bank was 100 years ago?
No.
Okay. It was a people's bank. It was run by the government for the people. It was by far the largest bank, brought enormous accountability to the private banks. Could you see Australia Post turned into a people's bank, a proper bank, not a bank at Post, but a proper bank, if LPOs were given training and had more secure storage so they could provide the full range of bank services?
You all said that we're very qualified to do that.
Yeah, you did use that word, qualified.
I don't think you're going to get a clearer answer.
No, exactly. Can you do postal banking? You know, certainly we're well situated to do it. And she had made that clear in earlier discussions about postal banking during the course of the hearing, that they are very well trained. They have the facilities to store cash safely. You know, it's very straightforward.
Yeah, and as one of the leaders of the LPO group, Scott Etherington, said at one of the previous hearings, so they already do full service banking for the banks that will let them do that for their clients.
Yeah.
It's only the big four banks that insist on driving everything into the wall to suit their own purposes and refusing to allow the post offices to provide the services that they would otherwise be happy to provide, you know, assuming that they're adequately paid by the banks to do that, which at the moment they're not, as we've talked about before.
Yeah, and I mean, the post office, you know, they are very well trained. They know what they're talking about. They know what they're doing. And of course, they're used to dealing with people. And I was at the post office just this week, and I saw one of the tellers there helping a lady with her banking, and she was an older lady and wasn't sure how she was going to pay her bill. And, you know, they go out of their way. And of course, this lady from the licensed post office in Bribie Island made that very clear. She was saying people need that face-to-face service. And when it comes to banks, she said they feel just dumped, and even she was used the word unloved. They've been thrown on the scrap heap. So she said we need these services to be provided. And then there was an example of many examples of that with witnesses who were then called, who were ordinary civilians, and also from the open mic session where people just gave examples of the experiences, as we've heard from some of the other hearings, all of the other hearings. One of them, I'll play a little bit of this, is one of our ACP supporters, and he's on the Chamber of Commerce there locally, Garth Gilbert. And he also raised the issue of, you know, the bank obligations to the local communities because, as we know, as Andy Schmulo made clear at the hearing in Adelaide, which was great, the banks are not repaying in kind the largesse that they get from governments and they get from the taxpayer. So we'll hear what Garth had to say.
The postal office lady there said she didn't know where the money would come from for whatever bank's going to turn up. We'll call it a people's bank, a public bank, or a post office bank. Well, the money's there. And one in my submission was mutual obligation. It never gets used by a politician, only when someone takes money from the Crown, i.e. robo-debt, i.e. anything to do with debt from a dole bludger, right? They go collect it. Now, the banks were given in the COVID period $188 billion at a low interest rate, which they invested. And where's the obligation with the Reserve Bank to collect that money? And nothing's been done. I haven't seen one banker prosecuted. I haven't seen one person prosecuted for robo-debt. And this is why I want a public bank. I don't want it. I want to demand it, that we have it. And you hold the future of everyone in this room and Australia with our money.
And we should also mention that, you know, Garth's also there in his capacity as a representative of military veterans, of which he is one himself, and that they too are being thrown on the scrap heap like everybody else. You know, they keep banging on about Anzac Day.
Yeah.
You know, the Anzac legend this, fighting for our freedom that. Now, of course, we've talked before a lot about how most of the wars that that this country sends people off to aren't anything to do with that, but that's not a slight against the soldiers. Mm. They're doing what they believe, what they're told is their duty.
Yeah.
And then they come home and they just get, oh, yeah, you're used up, you're thrown away, you don't matter anymore.
Absolutely. And Garth actually said, he said, just like I was drafted to go to war, he said, I feel like I'm being drafted with no choice into this digital dystopia, which was, you know, a very pertinent comment. There were also, in the open mic session, four ACP supporters of various calibres, including Jan Bacallus, our State Secretary, who talked about how even she had been scammed. So even people, as we all know, everyone knows someone that are switched on and cluey, it can happen even if she didn't even know, because it was charges on her credit card that had come in without her even noticing it on the credit card. So no phone call or anything to try to suck you into. It just happens. Now, I want to end this section with the clips on Senator Gerard Rennick talking about public banking, because he made an intervention at a certain point when Wendy Streets from the Financial Services Union was being interviewed. And, you know, obviously she said some things about, and she's said this in the past, about how the banks are being encouraged, or the banks basically, bank tellers have to tell people to go to the ATM, have to tell them to go online, etc. So there was some reiteration of that whole side of it. But Gerard Rennick intervened to put the proposal about public banking and took the chance to elaborate. It didn't end up being a question, and it was taken as a statement, but it was an excellent little intervention, and hopefully, you know, it bodes well in terms of what the recommendations of this inquiry will be next month on the 15th or 16th of May, the committee reports. Matt Canavan, the chair, you know, who ultimately gets the final say, had during this hearing been very positive towards postal banking. Now, that was likely, as we've seen in other hearings, because there was such overwhelming support for it. So, you know, whether or not he goes in that direction is yet to be seen. And, of course, people should always, particularly if you live in his electorate, let him know how you feel about that. But let's nevertheless listen to this statement from Senator Rennick.
So I believe that there is actually, we can make, you know, public bank could make money, and it could be actually legislated. And I was actually talking to Michelle Bullock about this just 2 weeks ago down in Sydney when I had to go down there for Public Works Committee, about the fact that all you'd have to do is mandate an 8% return on equity, because you couldn't run it too cheaply, because you'd undermine the profitability of the big banks to the extent. I mean, they make about 10 to 14% return on equity, and mind you, that's still twice the two to three times higher than the supermarkets, which are currently getting grilled right now over their profitability. So I believe that in itself would pay for the actual provision of better services, and it's something that we should also look at in regards to insurance, because I note that 40 to 50% of our insurance costs now are reinsurance fees paid offshore. So we've got all this money going offshore or, you know, being spent or while services are declining. And I think we really need to address this neoliberal philosophy of the 1980s that all competition is good. Competition can both be constructive and destructive. And we've seen since the privatisation of the CBA, all we've got out of it is, in many respects, a decline in services. The Banking Commission that people, Royal Commission people have referred to today, was actually a banking commission into misconduct in the financial services. And I'll note the comments before, the original 1937 Banking Royal Commission, actually one of the recommendations of that was that the central bank should always keep an eye on the distribution of credit. In 1985, when Paul Keating lifted those capital controls, we basically let the private banks run amok. So I guess this is more of a statement. So I guess
I'll bring you to a question, given the time.
Well, it's an important.
I'm wondering where the question
is. It's an important. Look, it's a really important point, because I think we can make it work. We managed, you know, Australia's prosperity. There's no coincidence that Australia's prosperity prospered and did very well when we had that publicly owned Commonwealth Bank that was originally set up by the Labor Party, but was added to in 1959 under Robert Menzies when he set up the Development Bank. And I think at the end of the day, we do have a responsibility to make sure we get services out to the people, and it can be done in a way that everyone's a winner. So, yeah, cheers.
Now, after the hearings, the lady from the LPO had invited people to come down to the post office and have a look. And as you'll see, we put up these photos here. Robbie did go down. A whole bunch of our crew went down. It was interesting because the lady from the licensed post office, we hadn't had any contact with her, and we asked her how she knew about the public bank. She was quite well versed in what it was and so forth. And she said, oh, I know nothing about it, she said, but my husband does. And it turned out her husband has been following us on the Citizens Report online. So call out to Mr. Stride. Good on you. So now I also want to mention on this front, this really shows the impact of people ringing their Member of Parliament, sending an email, going and visiting them. I want to play this short, very short clip from the House of Representatives on the 29th of March, where the Member of Parliament for Tangney in Western Australia, Sam Lim, got up and said that after receiving hundreds of emails and phone calls, he wanted to have something to say about bank closures. So we'll watch that.
Member for Tangney.
I speak today with a heavy heart about the recent action of banks like Bankwest, whom at short notice closed all their physical branches and moved everything online in my electorate of Tangney. In this difficult time when many in the community are struggling with the cost of living, it is hard to accept that banks are making it even harder to do simple things like banking. I have received hundreds of emails and calls from my constituents that are concerned and frustrated over the lack of social responsibility that banks have for the community. The closures of Bankwest branches only serve to widen the gap between those with easy online access and those without. Let us not forget that while these closures are occurring, banks continuing to report record profits. It is a stark reminder of the misalignment between the corporate priority and the societal needs. I ask the bank, including Bankwest, to think again about their decision. Banks need to understand that their action affect real people. I urge banks to reconsider their decision and their social obligation to communities they serve. Thank you, Madam Speaker.
So that's great. We need more of that. So, you know, keep on to your MP and keep on to your local media. There was one piece of reporting that came out in the wake of the inquiry ending its series of hearings was from Banking Day, and they, you know, reviewed this latest hearing at Bribie Island mostly and just asked some of the questions like, what will the committee recommend? They elaborated on various of the proposals that have been put forward during the course of the inquiry, including establishment of mandatory codes, more strict regulations, different banks sharing, you know, building locations, things like that that have been done overseas, expansions of bank at post, various other things. And then they came to the public bank and this is what they said. That old saw, the re-entry of the Commonwealth Government into the business of banking, potentially in collaboration with Australia Post in the manner of Kiwi Bank in New Zealand, found favour among many citizens who made submissions or gave evidence, but won't go anywhere.
Well, that's what they kept telling Jim Anderton and Matt Robson and the rest of those guys, but Jim Anderton led it in New Zealand, and then they got Kiwi Bank up anyway, and it was a smashing success and still is. And now their commerce regulator is calling for it to be given more resources to put our big four banks that own New Zealand's big banks back in their box like the government needs to do here.
Yeah, because the same problem, you know, they're facing the same problem over there with bank branch closures and local towns shutting down because of it, as we, you know, have seen as from this testimony this week.
Yep. And I should say, while Banking Day, you know, they're not exactly big fans of the big banks either, and so they might be poo-pooing this idea, but that publication gets widely read in the industry, so they're going to know that that's what's on everyone's mind.
This is a very real and live threat. And I'll just also remind people, we'll obviously have more marching orders coming forward and we have to see what the committee is going to say next month, but mid-year the Local Government Association will be meeting, so if you haven't already, get onto your local council about supporting a motion for a public postal bank, as 26 or more councils have done across Australia. And many councils, at least half a dozen, maybe more by now, are preparing to put up a motion at that Local Government Association event when it comes up. So that'll be a great debate that takes place there. Now, moving on, World War III. How long can we teeter on the brink? Obviously, you know, we've had a whole series of various conflicts that have put us, you know, on the path towards World War III. And there's a lot of nations and leaders and individuals that have done, you know, have done backflips trying to keep World War III from breaking out, because, you know, oftentimes there's just such a climate that the slightest thing can just put you on that pathway without, you know, even meaning to. The situation in the world is in that precise position right now. It's a tinderbox, and any spark, whether deliberate or not, can set it off. And I just want to take things back to Anzac Day 2 years ago, 2022, since we're coming up to Anzac Day, as you said. So in 2022, then Defence Minister Peter Dutton said, "The only way you can preserve peace is to prepare for war and be strong as a country, not to cower, not to be on bended knee and be weak." So remember that. And then remember, even 1 year earlier, Anzac Day 2021, the then Secretary of the Department of Home Affairs, Mike Pezzullo, who was, you know, he was always close to Dutton anyway in that whole network of people beating the drums of war, He wrote an article in The Australian headlined, "The Drums of War Are Growing Louder," which was received as something quite extraordinary at that time, I recall.
Yeah, and you know, this is he was the Secretary of the Department of Home Affairs at the time, but he has, most of his career has been spent in the Defence Department.
Mm.
So, you know, he's gone now. He got
That's what I was going to say. Where is he now?
Yeah, well, if people might recall, he was exposed as having been basically trying to set himself up as the power behind the throne of the whole government and deciding who should be minister, thinking he could decide who should be minister for this or that. And he got his emails got leaked by somebody, and that was the end of him.
Yeah.
Although he's starting to be quoted again just in the last couple of days, incidentally, in the press. They're going to try and rehabilitate this clown again.
Mm.
So.
And look, whether you're looking at Ukraine, Gaza, the situation with China. Look, geopolitics is the main game here. This is why that you're always having these provocations, why we're always getting close to the brink. And it's mainly motivated, people talk about the Thucydides trap, which is the idea that if you've got a major power which has been static or even collapsing, you know, and then you have coming onto the scene, a rising power like China or the broader arrangement of BRICS countries, China, Russia, etc., collaborators, the global majority rising, you know, you tend to have that power which is ebbing try to provoke a conflict.
Yeah, that's the thing that a lot of these people, everyone like Graham Allison, an American historian, I think he's American, he coined this term quite some years ago in a book. Most of them who like to quote that neglect to mention that it's always the declining power that starts the war because, if I don't do it now, it's going to be too late and I'll be superseded. And that's what's happening now.
Yeah.
We keep getting told, oh, China's aggressive, coercive, this, that or the other. Russia attacked, just woke up, Putin woke up one day and decided to invade Ukraine. It's garbage. The Iranian Ayatollahs woke up one day and decided to bomb Israel. You know, that's garbage too, which I know we're going to talk more about.
In a moment.
Into this,
Before we get into that, I wanted you to just say a few words about the article you wrote this week because, you know, in the media, the media's been talking about will Japan join AUKUS, will it not? But look, Japan is definitely coming into the mix. You've written about that, but also the Philippines is being brought in as a major pawn in this whole framework.
Yeah, well, see, this goes back, in its modern fate, it goes back, you know, 100 and more years, but as far as the Americans took over the former Spanish colony of the Philippines way back. But this modern phase goes back to the advent of the Asia pivot, the military rebalancing to Asia under Obama, and Julia Gillard accommodated it here, and Marines in Darwin, and progressively more US military equipment and soldiers and exercises, and they're bringing in more and more countries. We get this AUKUS thing in 2021. We're going to have nuclear submarines now. Can't have it for civilian power, but
no.
But we can have it. But we can have it to blow up the world. That's fine. So the Philippines had been an American colony. It got its independence post World War II, but it was kind of always on a bit of a leash. CIA subversion of governments with the two independence streak, like what they do everywhere, that sort of thing. The previous president, he had Rodrigo Duterte. He had a very independent foreign policy. He dropped the previous U.S. puppet government's confrontational stance towards China and started looking for ways to settle these territorial disputes that a whole bunch of the countries in the region have, without, you know, pointing guns at each other. Well, okay, how can we sort this out? And China's made concessions before to Vietnam and other, with these territorial disputes in the South China Sea and that whole area. But the new guys come in, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., 2 years ago, nearly, June, I think, 2022, and has just basically signed back up to the to Washington's agenda, based on his father was president. Mm. He was installed by the Americans and then deposed by the Americans when he got too independent back in the 80s. And so this Ferdinand Marcos Jr. has decided to dig in, been prevailed upon, convinced to dig in and pick a fight with China over this shoal, submerged shoal in the South China Sea somewhere that, as the the previous president's spokesman said, I've quoted him in the article, he's a geopolitical analyst and commentator, and Rigoberto Tiglar, he said, look, I guarantee 90% of Filipinos couldn't find that shoal on a map, and it'd fit in less than half of this lake that's Tal Lake, that's just next to the capital city of the Philippines. Nobody cared about this thing until they decided to reinterpret the Marine Rights Treaty to say, oh, that's in our exclusive economic zone, even though it's been part of Chinese territorial, you know, claims, Chinese-controlled territory for hundreds of years, as he goes through. I don't have time to go through all the details now, but that is the case.
And people are saying now that this decision by the Philippines to take this, to move in this direction, and of course it was reflected in the Philippine president's remarks when he was here in Australia in February, but that this is going to relegate the Philippines to being Asia's Ukraine.
Yeah. Setting up to militarise the country, like we're doing here.
Yeah.
But it is at the quote-unquote front line, as they say, of all of this. He's allowed the US military back in permanently. He's they're spending up big with money they don't have on military equipment, and all the money's going to go to Washington. And it's, as Brian Beletic, former US Marine analyst, there, he says this is crafted by Washington for Washington, and he also said you are setting yourself up to be the Ukraine of Asia if you follow through with this.
The Philippines will watch its economy spiral as public time, money, energy and attention is increasingly invested into a growing proxy conflict orchestrated by and for Washington. Mm. As you wrote, does that sound familiar, Australia? So read that in the alert service. And getting on to the Iran situation, because Iran-Israel... basically what you've had going on for some time now is Israeli targeting of Iran in various locales, and the latest of which has been the bombing and assassination of key military figures from Iran that were housed at the consulate in Damascus, Syria, which was the last straw and, of course, a breach of international law. Before Iran retaliated, it waited 10 days for the United Nations Security Council to have an opportunity to condemn that action by Israel, which was blocked by the Anglo-Americans as usual. Such a resolution wasn't forthcoming. And then Iran announced it was going to retaliate in a measured way. It gave 72 hours notice so that there was still an opportunity to wind back that UN decision, etc. And it even notified the United States. And even then, the retaliation it chose was a slow-moving retaliation, as you'll see. We're going to play a couple of clips from a Middle East expert, Alistair Crook, and he's talking here with Judge Andrew Napolitano on his YouTube channel. You can go there and watch the entire interview, but in the first clip I want to play, Alistair Crook talks about the danger of escalation because Israel has failed and has nowhere left to go. So we'll listen to that.
Well, when you look at the situation in Israel at the moment, where, and it's become, you know, something has changed in the air. Something is very clear that Israelis have the sense of defeat, which they haven't had until now, but they sense there is a defeat. They know that Gaza has been a defeat and that it's unlikely that they're ever going to prevail as they would like in Gaza. They haven't been able to restore the displaced persons to their homes. They have not been able, if you like, to get the hostages. That's at a dead end on the hostages. So wherever you look, there is a defeat, and the economy is tanking, and the sides, if you like, of the box are closing in on Israel. And so where is the way out for Israel? They need a diversion. They need something to get out of this. And that's where this great victory comes in, and the idea that they can score a great victory. And Netanyahu, for all these years, has always been, you know, target Iran. Iran is the great Satan that we must deal with. And this is why I think, you know, that we may see this conflict actually escalate further and widen further in this time, even though everyone has been trying very hard to not allow that to happen. But now it is really Israel that has the juncture in the road, the fork in the road. Either it has to accept where it is now and assimilate a defeat, military defeat, a defeat of its deterrence, a political internal defeat, or it has to go all the way, Armageddon, war, Amalek.
All right, so yeah, the likelihood of Israel saying, oh, we acknowledge defeat, you know, we'll stop, is very unlikely.
Yeah, it's not high.
But, you know, as he said in that, I think it was in that clip we just heard, he talked about how so many people have done so much to keep the world back from the brink of World War III. And look, when you hear this next bit and what I've just explained, Iran is one of them. I mean, you know, go figure. Iran is one of the countries that is acting with caution and responsibility to keep back from the brink of World War III. But just like Russia and China and other countries, there's a limit. You know, they're going to respond. They have to defend themselves and their sovereignty. So I want to play now this next clip where Alistair Crook explains what Iran's intention was, because, of course, all of the Western media has cast what Iran did as a complete failure. Well, actually, it's far from it.
So the aim of this was simply to do one thing, to reestablish deterrence. For this last period, Israel has been assassinating Iranians in Syria and in Lebanon, and then finally in their diplomatic premises in Damascus. And Iran wanted to send this message of deterrence. And of course, it's been misinterpreted widely in the West because, first of all, the drones that they fired, and they made it clear that they weren't looking to do a major destruction in Israel, but to send a clear message of a new equation. What's the equation? The equation is, if you go on attacking Iran, in Iran, or Iranians outside of it, from henceforth, you will be attacked direct from Iran into Israel. That is the new equation. We will attack you inside Israel from Iran. That's what the purpose was. That's what they did. Now, all those drones, they take 3.5 hours to arrive at their target. They're very slow moving. The cruise missiles go faster and the ballistic missiles faster still. So they mix these things up. The point is that the drones were put up to be shot down, because those drones, just as we've seen in Ukraine and elsewhere, the drones are used to map out the air defenses of Israel. And so the Iranians will have got a lot of information about the air defenses and the capabilities by putting up these old, slow drones that take 3 hours to get there. So, you know, everybody knew they were coming. I mean, it was very clear when they started taking off that it would take that long. Now, they mixed that with two things, cruise missiles, some of them ground-hugging and some of them ballistic missiles. And a number of the ballistic missiles broke through all the air defenses. They destroyed two air bases, or not destroyed them, but they landed in two air bases into an intelligence building in Tel Aviv, the Air Force intelligence building from where the, if you like, the attack in Damascus was coordinated, and also an electronic center on the Golan. And there were no casualties, and the damage was not, you know, world-shaking, but it sent a clear message, and it said, we have the capabilities. Now, in the newspapers, in the media, it says, oh, well, 99% of them were shot down. I mean, that's nonsense. 99% of the drones were shot down because they were put up to be shot down. So that, first of all, it gives cover for the other missile systems, and also because it allows the Iranians to map, if you like, the ground of Israeli air defenses. Israeli air defenses were not able to stop the ballistic missiles. They know that. They will go on with the propaganda, and the West is pushing this propaganda very strongly in order to try and deter Netanyahu from making a strike against Iran in retaliation.
Yeah, so, I mean, a good rule of thumb. Remember these names, Scott Ritter, Andrew, Alistair Crook, they sort of follow them and not the mainstream media, or just assume the opposite of what your government and media tell you, and you'll probably be on a better track.
Yeah, because Scott Ritter also said that the way Iran reacted was very effective. So keep an eye on that analysis. And speaking about the media spin and hypocrisy on these issues, I want people to hear this clip, which you might have seen doing the rounds on Twitter and so forth. But in this clip, David Cameron, the British
Foreign Secretary,
again in his reincarnation, was asked about Iran's retaliation and its right to indeed retaliate. So see how he responds.
A reckless and dangerous thing for Iran to have done. And I think the whole world can see all these countries that have somehow wondered, well, you know, what is the true nature of Iran? It's there in black and white.
What would Britain do if a hostile nation flattened one of our consulates?
Well, we would take, we would take the very strong action.
All right, so there you go.
Yeah, and this is an important point. As we say, assume the opposite of what your government and media tell you. Iran is the responsible, what they say, adult in the room here, not Israel. Mm. Iran has followed international law to the letter in this situation with admirable restraint.
Yeah.
Israel has broken it in every respect for years, but especially, now they've been, as you said, they've been assassinating Iranian officials anywhere they could find them, but blowing up an embassy, a consulate, that is an attack on sovereign territory. That is an act of war, unprovoked, unjustifiable.
Yeah.
And that's not me saying so. That's UN rapporteurs. That's everybody, But the media, the mainstream media won't tell you that. Follow guys like Scott Ritter and people like us. If you want to know what's really going on.
All we can say is that this geopolitical equation has to be changed. Cook spoke about how Iran wanted to change the equation. Well, what we discussed earlier in terms of the Thucydides trap, the rising power phenomenon, and how a declining power reacts to that, that equation on the broader picture has to be changed. And as we pointed out in the lead of our Australian Alert Service this week, because Australia is operating from within that Anglo-American alliance, that declining power, and we have a voice here, which is rising also because of the conduct of our allies in the question of the Assange case and so many other cases, we have the possibility to fracture that Anglo-American alliance and this push for war that it's leading from within. So, do read the material, do make your voice heard. It does make an impact. We have seen, more of a beginnings of a shift of the government at least making overtures on Assange, not enough, nowhere near enough. But look, at a certain point, they've got to be more scared of us and the people and the population bearing down on them. There is an election coming up than they are of their dangerous Anglo-American allies, and more scared of war, to be frank, more scared of World War III. So don't be afraid to shoot them an email, send them make a phone call, whatever you can do, and do that at the local level as well, because the voice will build from below up through the layers. So that's the show for this week. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks, Richard.
Thanks, Liz.
And join us again next week.
authorised by Robert Bowick, Citizens Party, Melbourne.